providing unique reporting on markets and companies since 1990. This is the Cortland Economics Report.
All right, welcome back. Continuing to listen to the weekend edition of the KE Report. And as promised, in the back half of this show, we are going to be focusing a bit more on the resource sector, as we are now chatting with Adrian Day, founder of Adrian Day Asset Management, also manages the Euro-Pacific Gold Fund. Now, it's been a little while since I last had Adrian on the show. And Adrian, before we dive into some of the individual resource sectors, which is where I really want to go to focus on if or where opportunities are for investors, a broad market comment from you, please, because look, everyone's still very focused on what central banks are doing, if the Fed will raise, if they won't raise rates. A lot of people are watching the bond market as the bond sell-off has continued and yields have really spiked to levels we haven't seen in quite a while, especially uptrends that we haven't seen in decades. Plus, everyone's still waiting for this recession to happen, which now a lot of these calls have been pushed out to next year. So, Adrian, just in an overall market sense, how do you see kind of the big picture narrative playing out?
Yeah, I think the market participants are correct to look at the Fed and what the Fed is doing and what the Fed is likely to do. But of course, as we know, and as you indicated, there's also a market. You know, the Fed doesn't dictate policy, or doesn't dictate what happens to markets. And one of the things that's happening now that is really extremely important is what you mentioned about long rates moving up. And the rates on long bonds are moving up despite what the Fed would like. And that, I think, is very, very significant. And part of that, of course, is because we've had a huge extra issuance of treasuries in the second half of this year, both because the debt has gone up, the deficit's gone up, so it has to be financed because of a lockdown. So you had the debt ceiling talks earlier in the year. You had a period there of a few months where the Treasury was not allowed to issue any new treasuries. So they were pushed into the second half along with the normal second half. And then, of course, you've also had a lot of treasuries roll over. The Treasury for the last few years in the U.S., as well as in other countries, frankly, many other countries, frankly, was issuing more and more of its debt at the short end. They issued at the short end instead of a long end. So a lot of those are rolling over. Well, when they roll over, that's all new issue supply. So you've got supply going up, but equally important, and perhaps more important in the longer term, is you've got a shortage of buyers. I mean, there's never a shortage of buyers at the right price, obviously. People will buy Argentine debt at the right price. But the foreign central banks that have been traditional buyers, China, Japan, even Russia, are not buying anymore. The Fed is not buying anymore. The Federal Reserve, which was the number one buyer of treasuries for years, which in itself is somewhat perverse, but nonetheless, they're not buying anymore. And the U.S. banks, which have traditionally been a large buyer of treasuries, are not buying, or buying much less, I should say, in their case, for various reasons. So you've got the traditional buyers not in the market. You've got an extra supply. And so, as I mentioned, yes, you can clear the market, but you clear at a price. What price? And so the buyers that are there are demanding a higher price. That is very, very significant because it messes up the Fed's plans and potentially means that the Fed will have to come back in and start buying long bonds again. So that's one thing. The second thing, you mentioned recession. I think it's critical that we don't fall into the trap of saying, well, because there's been no recession in the last 18 months of tightening in the US and around the world, therefore we've got a soft landing. We all know that monetary policy works with lags, and those lags are long. And the average length in the U.S. over the last seven recessions going back to the early 1960s, the average time frame from the first rate hike to the onset of a recession was 22 months. So even though we've had the most rapid increase percentage-wise in interest rates in history in the U.S. from 0 to 5.5, the time frame is still lower than the average of recessions back to 1960. So I think we are still definitely on track for a recession. I think people who think that we've missed it this time are really not looking at history and not looking at economic theory either. Because if you think about, I won't go into this too much, but just if you think about the way the economy works, which means the way individual businesses, households react to things, it takes time before an increase in interest rates severely cuts into your spending and companies laying off people and so on. It takes time for that to happen. So I think two things. One is we're definitely on track for a recession in my mind, and the Fed is now in a place where a lot of us have been saying they're heading this way. It's now upon the Fed, but they're in a situation where the economy is slowing. Inflation is not under control yet. And we can talk about inflation if you want, but inflation is not under control yet. And they're in a situation where they're going to have to stop raising rates because of the impact it's having on the market, on the bond market, because of the impact it's having on the federal government, the debt servicing. And frankly, because it's an election year next year, and the Fed has always been reluctant to be too tight in an election year, and they certainly don't want to provoke a serious recession in an election year.
Yeah, Adrian, it's going to be interesting to follow along with how some of these trends resolve themselves. Will the Fed have to switch from QT back to QE and start buying bonds to support the markets? What is the effect of this higher for longer on the housing market, on auto loans, on business loans? How does it affect the consumer? Because some of people's debt hasn't even rolled over yet, but when they face those higher interest rates, that's going to impact their spending, both on the corporate side and on the consumer side. But let's translate this over to how it relates to the markets. You know, when you look at gold as a safe haven, it's done okay in the face of such an aggressive rate hiking cycle, but it's not blowing out the doors, not breaking any records to new highs, despite all of the volatility we've seen. What do you make of the gold market in light of all these macro forces and in an environment where now savers can pile into money markets at 5.5%, kind of taking away some of the shine from gold?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, fundamentally, what you said is correct, but I would disagree with you. I would disagree with the sort of premise that, you know, gold hasn't really done that well. I mean, if you think back a year ago, gold was at a little over 1600, and it's now over 1900, and it's been as high as, you know, whatever, 1950 or something. So that's a pretty, to me, that's a pretty strong move. Let's just say $300. That's a pretty strong move in 12 months from an asset that is supposed to be an insurance asset, a hedge. It's not meant to be a speculative asset, and an asset in the face of a strong stock market until very recently, a strong stock market, which is an alternative to gold, obviously, and in the face of hiking, interest rates moving up and moving up into positive real rates in the US and many other places in the world, which is also negative for gold. And as you say, you know, the alternative now of getting 5% on a 3-month, 6-month treasury is pretty compelling, is pretty strong competition for gold. So I think gold has done well in the face of that tightening. It always, to me, it always was a matter of when does the market realize or believe, whichever, when does the market come to realize that the Fed will be unable to raise interest rates sufficiently to kill inflation for whatever reason. And I think we weren't there last month. We weren't there the month before, but I think we're getting very, very close to that point now. And of course, you know, the conflict in the Middle East has perhaps made it more difficult. I think the Fed wanted one more rate hike this year. If you go back to August, September, I think most of the members wanted another rate hike because that would show that they were still, inflation fighting was still dominant. And if you look at the dot plots, you know, what's called the dot plots, you know, where the different Fed members make their predictions of where interest rates, economy, you know, unemployment and so on are going to be this year, next year. If you look at the dot plot from September, most members of the Fed, all but two, in fact, thought there were going to be at least one rate hike before the end of the year. And almost half of them were expecting two rate hikes before the end of the year. So I think the Fed was wanting and expecting a rate hike. Obviously, you know, what's happened in the Middle East has made it a little more difficult to raise rates. The big fuss over the budgets in the U.S. and the possibility of a lockdown, government shutdown, that's made it more difficult to raise rates. And so we're beginning to run out of time for a rate hike before the end of the year, but it still may come. But my point is that once we get past that, once we get into the new year, I think it's going to become becoming increasingly evident that the Fed is not going to be able to raise rates sufficiently to kill inflation. And let's not forget, you go back to the 1970s, and I make this point many times, Arthur Burns, the much non-lamented poor old Arthur Burns, he raised rates after the recession of 1974. He raised rates every single quarter. Every single quarter, he was increasing interest rates, but he was only doing it in tandem with the increase in inflation. And when Volcker came in, rates were already, Fed funds rates were already in double digits when Volcker came in. We forget that. But what Volcker did, of course, was he raised rates to almost 20% and got them well ahead of inflation. And that's what's necessary. It's not just enough to raise rates, and it's not even enough to have positive real rates. You've got to get, if you want to kill inflation, you've got to get those rates well ahead of inflation. And the Fed, unfortunately, it just doesn't have that flexibility right now. Can you imagine if right now Powell were to raise the Fed funds rate from 5.5%, and he were to raise it to 8 or 10%, which would be the equivalent of what Volcker did, raising from 12% to 20%. That would destroy destroy government finances. It would destroy the economy. He just can't do that. So I think we have to accept that we have to realize that the likelihood is that inflation will not be killed before the Fed has to pause. And that's positive for gold.
Okay, as much as gold has done well and these factors that everyone's looking at, let's talk about the gold stocks, because that's I really do like reading through some of your reports covering a wide range of gold stocks, large down to some of the explorers, all of which are struggling. Even the majors that are generating some decent cash flow, although their margins haven't exploded higher, they're also struggling on a share price basis. So Adrian, why are we in this environment where gold is doing well, holding right above 1900, even as we're recording this, it's back above 1900. Why are the stocks struggling and still very much in long-term downtrends?
Yeah, no, and I'll be honest. I mean, I am surprised that the gold stocks are quite as undervalued as they are, given the gold price, given the environment as well. Given the strong cash flows, as you say, the cash flows for the seniors are really quite robust relative to the last 10 years, and given the outlook. I think that we can say a couple of things. You know, if you look at the last 12 months up until, say, September, and you see that huge dichotomy between the gold price and the gold stocks, and everybody assumes, well, that means the gold stocks have to catch up. Well, it doesn't, of course. It might mean that gold comes down. It might mean that gold was overpriced, overvalued, rather than the gold stocks were undervalued. And I think we began to see evidence that that was, or indications that that was indeed the case. We started to see that in September and then right at the beginning of this month when gold fell sharply. And the point I would make is that over the last 12 months, from last October all the way through to September or August, the gold price was really supported by the central banks. We all know about, the record buying of central banks, but that was really supporting the gold price. You look at ETFs, the gold ETFs, they were seeing massive outflows and consistent outflows. Again, over the last 12 months, there's only been maybe, was it February, March or March and April? I forget now, but only 2 months, which saw positive inflows into the gold ETFs. Every other month, we were seeing these outflows, and they were heavy and consistent outflows. And so it wasn't investors who were supporting gold. It wasn't speculators who were supporting gold. It was the central banks. And the problem with that, of course, is you're looking at a relatively small handful of players. So you only need a handful of players, for whatever reason, to pause their buying for a month or two for it to affect the gold price. And in the last numbers that came out, the last numbers I'm pretty sure were for July. I should have looked this up. I'm sorry. The last numbers that came out from the World Gold Council for July showed a leveling off of gold buying by the central banks. I wouldn't be at all surprised if when we see August and particularly September's numbers, when they're released, I wouldn't be at all surprised if we see that gold buying from the central banks fell reasonably sharply in those months. And that's what provoked, likely, that's what provoked the gold sell-off. That doesn't mean that central banks have stopped buying gold forever. I don't mean to imply that at all. I just mean that after a year of some pretty aggressive buying, widespread buying, and record buying, a pause was not unexpected. Gold was probably ahead of itself, was overpriced to where it, quote, should be. I hate using the word should when you talk about what the gold price is, but it was ahead of itself, which meant the gold stocks were, yes, undervalued, but perhaps less undervalued than otherwise would appear. And of course, with a strong stock market, when people, and these things build on themselves, when people are looking at every quarter for some companies, every year for other companies, where do I allocate my 401k money this year? Well, the stock market's doing pretty well. Let's put it in the stock market. Do you want to buy any gold or resources? You've got to be joking, right? No. So everybody, it just builds on itself. Because the stock market is doing well, people are less interested in buying gold stocks. You know, that will change. I mean, from a contrarian point of view, the total lack of interest in gold stocks, but absolute lack of interest outside the gold investors, the gold community, is just astonishing. You know, if you talk to most investors, they don't even want to have a discussion about it. It's not that they're negative. They're just not interested. Well, that's from a contrarian point of view, that is very, very compelling, because when that changes, the potential for big moves in gold stocks is very, very high indeed.
Well, Adrian, it's true that maybe gold had gotten a little ahead of itself in valuation. But when you look at these gold stocks, it's not just that they're undervalued. They're massively undervalued. If you look at where the margins were back in the 2009 through 2011 run after the great financial crisis, you know, we were seeing margins and the producers that weren't that different from where they are today. But these stocks are at about a half or a third of the value, a lot of the mid-tiers of where they were trading back then. When you look at the 2016 rally that we saw from January to August, gold wasn't even like 1375 is where it got up to. And these stocks were valued higher then. When you look at ounces in the ground and development companies, they were fetching $100, $200, $300 an ounce in the ground at the peak of the cycle. We're looking at companies all the time where they're getting $20 an ounce, $15 an ounce, $10. We've even seen some at $5. Silver companies just a year or two were getting $3 an ounce in the ground. Now they're getting $1 an ounce in the ground. So these companies are not getting any value for all of the work they've done defining these resources. What do you make of that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that gold stocks are incredible value right now. But I'm just trying to say why are they so undervalued? And it's because the stock market is strong and people are buying other things and making money in other things. And let's face it, people, generalists, people have been burned with the gold stocks before. They've been burned many times. They bought them in, you know, 2006 when they looked cheap and they had a year before they collapsed. They bought it in 2016 when they looked cheap, and they had 3 months before they collapsed. So they've been burned. And, you know, if you're a generalist investor and you say, well, let's just buy the biggest and the best. Let's buy Newmont and Barrick. You know, they're good, big companies. Well, if you held those for 40 years, you've lost money. You have lost money over 40 years. And so is it any wonder that people are not overly interested in rushing back? But I mean, I think that's the compelling. I agree with you 100%. I couldn't be more on your side. The valuations, the values in the gold stocks, both among the large producers, the mid-tiers, the intermediate producers, the exploration companies, the valuations are extremely compelling in my mind. And when the sentiment changes, we're going to see strong moves in those stocks. No, I agree completely. I mean, the gold stocks, talking about the seniors, the producers, they are in much better financial shape than they were, let's say, 10 years ago or even 20 years ago. Today, you've got the XEU, which is cash positive on balance, is cash positive. That in itself is astonishing for a capital intensive industry where you expect that. You know, you expect people who have to spend millions, hundreds of millions of dollars building mines, you expect them to have debt. But they're cash positive right now. You look at the yields, which are better than the yield. Nobody buys a gold stock for yield, or I don't think you should, but the yields are better than the S&P. The book values are lower than the S&P. No, I agree with you completely. The valuations are compelling. That's all I can say.
Yeah, well, these share prices, they have struggled. But again, these companies are not making the same margins that they were back at that last major run in about 2011, simply because costs have crept. But they've cleaned up their balance sheets and they are making money. We just need to see them start to use that money to buy other companies, to free up other capital. What about some other resource sectors here? Mostly this green transition, these critical minerals, which it seems like a number of gold bugs want to almost discredit or poo-poo on. But the fact of the matter is I've seen way more new investors come into the resource space because of this critical minerals movement. And I realize some of these small sectors that go on big runs can become very overvalued. But again, it's a sector within this resource sector that I think should almost more be embraced because it is capturing a younger audience. Adrian, how do you feel about some of these critical minerals and some of the runs that they've been on?
Yeah, okay. No, some broad points first, if I may. I mean, I've been around in this business a long time. And if we go and look in the books, even if you don't remember it, we all remember, you know, the nickel boom in Australia in the 1960s and the rare earth boom in the 1990s and the, you know, so on. Strategic metals, they were called back then, the strategic metals boom in the 1990s and so on and so forth. And all of these booms have ended in tears for investors, all of them, every single one of them. So first of all, I'm nervous and cautious. I miss things, there's no question, but I'm cautious on jumping on bandwagons, you know, where we've seen such strong moves. That's the first point. The second point I'd make is that notwithstanding that some of these critical minerals, you know, we can mention lithium or whatever, you know, several of them, are indeed essential and are there's going to be a huge increase in demand for them with the electrification of transportation and the electrification of the power grid. No question about that. My concern, I guess, would be one of substitution. So if we buy, to take a silly example, if you look at gold and if they suddenly discover that, you know, aluminum fillings works better than gold fillings, that substitution does not change the thesis for investing in gold. And that was a bit of a silly example, I'm sorry. But if you look at lithium, Elon Musk comes up with a lithium battery that uses a quarter or a tenth of the lithium the current batteries do. That has a meaningful effect, and meaningful is also English understatement, a meaningful effect on the lithium market, because lithium's uses are pretty narrow. And so I'm always concerned, and that's a longer-term story, of course, but I'm concerned with substitution, which you don't see so much in, say, copper or gold, etc. Now, the way I'm playing it, this is just my preference, to be honest. My preference is not to buy into stocks of pure lithium players. We have one or two, I'll have to say, but they're pretty small in my overall portfolio. But rather to get my, and we mentioned lithium as an example, to get my lithium exposure through other companies that I like anyway. Now, I don't mean RTZ, where, you know, lithium price could double and it won't mean too much to RTZ, but I'm talking about companies like Altius, you know, which had a large, which has, you know, a large shareholder and plus royalties in a lithium spinoff, or a company like Midland, which Midland Exploration, which is in Quebec and is exploring for gold and nickel and copper and everything else you want. But they also have two large strategic alliances on their ground looking for lithium. So one with Brunswick, one with RTZ. So if they discover something on one of those projects, yes, it won't be, the returns won't be as good as if, you know, you invested in Brunswick and they had a discovery, but they'll be satisfactory. They'll be sufficiently satisfactory, particularly given the lower risk with investing in a more diversified portfolio. So that's how I'm getting my exposure. And that holds for rare earths. It holds for cobalt. It holds for, you know, a lot of other things.
Okay. Hey, Adrian, it's great having you back on the show. Thank you very much for your time. Unfortunately, we are out of time for this segment, but I hope you have a great rest of your weekend. I'll follow up with you in a month or two time to get some more insights and dive a little bit more into some of these individual resource sectors. Everybody, thanks for tuning in on this weekend show. Please be sure to go back through our website, kereport.com, and podcast The KE Report to listen to all the daily editorials and company updates. We hope you all have a great rest of your weekend. We'll be back with you on Monday. Adrian, again, thank you for joining us this weekend.
Thank you so much.